pushing that button. And every now and then I'm going to look at this thing and make sure it's running. Today is September 19th, 2014. We're at the Tucson Fire Department, Station 1, with Robbie Evans and Laura Pitzinger. Robbie, can you spell your name for me, please?
My last name?
Yeah.
Evans.
Thanks, and Laura?
Pitsinger.
And my name's Tom Martin. So, Laura, I'll ask you first. How long have you been here at Station 1?
Since 2001.
And how long have you been at Grand Canyon?
Since 1985.
Okay, and Robbie, how long have you been at Grand Canyon?
1992.
Okay, and started at Station 1?
I started at the Grand Canyon Airport, or Marina Station?
Yeah.
I started here and as a volunteer in 1998 when they started it. And I became the fire chief in June or July 1st of 1999.
Okay. What was it like here before this fire station was built? Where were you guys stationed out of?
I worked at the Grand Canyon Airport.
I was in Cottonwood, Arizona.
Okay.
For a police department.
Okay. Yeah. So if there was a 911 call here in Tucson, how would that be responded to?
It would be responded to basically by the Park Service. They used to do the transports and provide the EMS out to Tucson.
Okay. And so when did it become apparent that Tucson needed its own EMS?
When the park started having budget problems, they decided, we were warned when we used to respond from the airport to assist for stuff in Tucson, that they were getting some grief from up above about responding to Tucson, and there would be days, like when we worked at the airport as EMT firefighters, that we request an ambulance. You know how it is here in the summer, where we could be on scene with a patient for over an hour.
Waiting for the Park Service to bring out an ambulance?
Right, because there's days they get hammered. And there was no, until I took over, I think in 2000, we made an approach to Guardian Medical Transport out of Flagstaff to get an ambulance up here, because at that time there was no advanced life support providers outside the park, and there was no ambulance service. Everybody came up from, the only one that came up was the guy from Williams, XL Ambulance. And I probably, in all the years I've been here, previous to 2000, I could probably count on one hand how many times I've seen XL come up to actually transport a patient. It was from the clinic.
Going out, not coming.
No, not to come help us.
Right. So then this facility here, Station 1, was built when? When did it come online?
We started across the street in the old Papillon hangar, right over there where Big E's is, so you can't see it. Which you remember. We had one or two bays in there and a little teeny office. We had it at 19... I think they started about somewhere in 99 where they hired a full-time person and we had one fire truck. And then I got on board, and me and a deputy chief who worked part-time and another gal. And
who were they?
Tim Crocker, which you probably remember from back in the old Park Service. He worked for Fred Harvey, Fire and Safety.
Okay.
One of the few with gray hair. Remember that? He worked there, and his girlfriend actually used to be a nurse at the clinic.
Who was?
Rendy.
Her last name's a Bell now, I think.
Yeah, it was. I think maybe it was Banning. Yeah.
Doesn't ring a bell. So this would have been 1996, 97-ish?
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. I don't know how long she was at the clinic for, because I barely knew her. When Rick and Susan got married, this, I think, the first time I'd ever seen her.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so then eventually you moved from across the street over to here.
Right. We tore Ann Wren was in Clarinda Vale. There used to be an old dormitory here and the old gas station out there in the parking lot. Ann and Red Feather Properties worked together. We got this property. We had to tear down the old dorms that used to be here. And they started building this. So when did we get here?
I think we finally moved in in like 2004. Probably took like a year.
We kind of miss our old wild squirrel that used to live in the file cabinets and the one computer we all shared. And so, our station dog.
I forgot to tell you, getting a little ahead, two things. If you see me doing hand signals, moving my hands apart or twiddling them around like this, tell me more. Tell me more about the squirrels in the closets and this and that. And then if I make a T, let's time out. Let me ask you a question.
All right.
Okay.
Hand signals, remind me.
So, tell me more about the squirrels.
Well, in the old station, we just had this little teeny office. What was it about? 4 or 5 foot wide, about,
yeah, it's
you know, as wide as maybe 12 foot long. Her and I had desks in there. We had a little black dog that somebody threw out of the window of a car. Mm. And we tried to give it away, and nobody would take it. That's her in her prime. Right now she's 14 years old. She's been, we called her Crash. Nobody wanted her, so we ended up, she was a station dog, and then I started taking her home, and then Laura ended up having her, and we named her appropriately, because I think she's on her 15th life in 14 years. So she's been on, we pretty much raised her from a pup. She's been on head-on collisions with us in the truck, cardiac arrests, plane crashes. It just, it was low-key and fun back in those days.
So what would the dog do when you got to the head-on?
We'd leave her in the truck.
And she would just sit there happily?
Mm-hmm.
She just watched.
That's great.
She was a fire dog. She had a little white on her. we called her our Dalmatian in disguise. And to this day, if you go all the way to Phoenix, or you put her in the truck, even though she can't see anymore, she won't lay down. She has to sit up in the passenger seat and look straight ahead the whole way. She's like the Budweiser dog on the wagon. She's still that way. You can go all the way to Phoenix, and she will never, ever lay down. She's sitting right in the passenger seat looking out the front window.
Wow.
And she's got cataracts. I don't know what she's seeing. But she's still that way. She won't sleep. Yeah. She'll never lay down. So, anyway, we had squirrels in the office, one old fire truck. To try to get the fire department going, we used to, you know, after training night, we'd have a beer or two afterwards and try to build some camaraderie and get everybody together. And those were good old days.
And this was a volunteer crew, except for one or two paid positions?
I was paid part-time for 2 days a week, and I think they paid maybe Tim Crocker maybe for 1 day a week or something like that.
And what were you doing otherwise?
I was still at the airport. I was at operations supervisor, EMT, firefighter, training officer.
Okay, yeah. So that position was easily known to you as far as what needed to be done. And
mm-hmm.
So was it a fairly easy transition segue over to here then, full-time? How did that work out?
It's a long time ago to remember, but I think it was a fairly easy transition, trying to build the numbers up in Tucson, because my personal opinion is seeing nobody can own anything here, there's no buy-in by anybody. So versus a little town like, say, Williams, where you can have a volunteer fire department, because, you know, the parents lived there, their grandparents lived there, they lived there. Here, October or when the tourist season's gone, adios, you lost your job and your housing. So we've continually had a problem keeping volunteers. I mean, I think if I go back and look, I bet we've had in 15 years or more, or whatever, how long this thing, 16 or 17 years, even before I got here, I think we have something in the neighborhood, I bet we've had anywhere from 300 to 400 volunteers.
And is that normal for a normal rural fire, volunteer fire department?
I grew up in upstate New York in a small town, smaller than this, and 150 people in the 1960 census, and when I left in the 70s, I think we had 86 members. That's, the fire department was a social function, and it was the old days. We had beer in the station, we played euchre after training night, we had a hall, we did bingo, we did weddings, but it's kind of like every volunteer organization. 10 of us did everything and worked everything, and all the rest brought their cousins and aunts and uncles out of the mountains when there's free beer and hot dogs.
How is that different from here in Tucson, Ben? Like I say, huge turnover of people.
Well, see, there, I mean, it's like my dad was on the volunteer fire department. He actually went exempt at some point. You know, like, here's a pass. You are still a member, but you're exempt. And I mean, when I was there, the guys that are now my age or a little younger than me, that are all, God bless their souls, are all gone now. But, I mean, they were all, you know, you lived there. Your family was there. You owned your home. And, I mean, everybody knew each other. Here, you don't. Tucson's not like that. So anyway, I mean, Tucson is such a transient community. I mean, even working at the airport, I think how many people, my years there, I think we had, I'm going to say we had, there's probably been over 100 employees in the 15 years I've been here. You come here, you're either made to live in the Grand Canyon or Tucson, or you aren't. You can come here and go, oh, it's beautiful, it's nice, and then they go, your wife goes, get out of here, there's no theater, you got to drive 150 miles to the grocery store. Where's a doctor?
And I think with that being said, it's also hard because people come here and then it's a training ground. They usually want to get training here and do a few calls and then move on to where they can get a real job doing it for real pay. Mm-hmm. And so we see a lot of that. We'll help people get started, help them get their training, and then they move away and then we're starting all over again.
Yeah, I think we've trained. I mean, we're both certified instructors through Coconino Community College for EMS. I'm a certified fire instructor. The old Park Service Fire Chief Kent Meekum and I co-taught quite a few Firefighter 1 and 2 academies. Laura and I, Nancy Meekum, we've done a whole bunch of, five or six EMT classes through COCO. And you get them trained, I bet we've trained maybe 150, 200 people in EMS, and they get it and they're gone. Same with fire.
I think that's what the difference is, like, you know, from being back east, being on a fire, you know, volunteer fire department, it's part of doing the family thing, and it's tradition, and you want to help people, and that's why you get into it. And here, it's a little bit of that, but more, I think, it's just becoming like just getting training and moving on because people don't seem to be
right.
as dedicated into helping people. It's just not like it used to be in the old days.
It's not like, you know, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you know, you're going to go maybe help. Like where I grew up, the guy I grew up next to is still there in upstate New York. I stopped and seen him me and my mom stopped and seen him. He used to be the chief of the fire department I was with. My next door neighbor there, Cliff London, my dad was always out hunting, and all my brothers and sisters were born during deer hunting season. So Cliff London took my mother to the hospital so many times when she was pregnant in labor that he said, if this one's a boy, you better name it Cliff. You're never going to get that here.
So it sounds like in rural communities, the fire station becomes the hub of a community, if you will. Then where is the hub of Tucson, or is there one? And there may not be one. I don't know.
I don't think there is a cohesive anything here. Transit nature of the community, basically Zantara, Fred Harvey, whatever you have here. It's changed over the years where we start having J1, 2, 3, whatever they call those students, which are kind of a little bit better crowd than back in the old days where, you know, they'd be bringing them out of homeless shelters and stuff like that. You're never going to find.
Yeah. I think internally we have a hub with our people.
Right.
You kind of become like a fire department family. You know, you go on stuff that's bad and, you know, you learn everybody's family and wives and kids.
We've seen one of our guys, little boy, first day home from the hospital, little Daniel Cockrum. I'm going to say this. Is he 15 now? we have a picture of him sitting in our fire truck, his dad holding him. Now I see Daniel. He's taller than me. I think he's I don't know if he's a freshman or his last year of junior high school. Their little baby. I mean, we've seen people get married, the kids grow up. I mean, we have a pretty tight little core here. But Mike went to school at the Grand Canyon. He graduated from Grand Canyon's high school. I think his dad was a maintenance guy up there or something. I don't know what his dad was. But Mike, I mean, you go up there and he's in all those pictures and the thing, you know, big set, you know, that like early 70s or 80s, big pompadour hairdo, you know. So we have a lot of pretty close-knit. We've been best man and bridesmaids in our people's weddings, and I mean, we've...
And pallbearers at funerals.
Pallbearers at funerals for some locals that have went early. So.
Yeah, well, that's a question I do want to ask you at one point, is your remembrances of the services at the Grand Canyon Cemetery. Tell me about the people that you've had to say goodbye to. But if I back up a little bit, it sounds like, though it isn't necessarily what a typical rural community would be, there mm-hmm. is still, like you said, internally a very tight-knit group mm-hmm. of people, which I think would be very, very helpful. Question I've got for you is, how did your relationship with the Park Service, how does that work? You mentioned Zantara Fire and Safety, or Fred Harvey Fire and Safety. How does the Park Service kind of work into all this? You mentioned Kent and Nancy.
In this day and age, it's not the same as it used to be back in the 90s. I mean, we do picnics and cook together and have a cerveza. It was a Yogi Bear, Ranger Smith thing. They were all friendly, neighborly. You didn't get pulled over for having a license plate light out. Or for smoking crack cocaine that you weren't. But it's not that anymore. There's really a dysfunction between government, the big government, and the public, I think. The Park Service has become this... They can skew their facts whatever they want to skew them, saying, oh, we have all these visitors, and, you know, if you think about it right now, there's more rangers on duty on the South Rim than there are sheriffs on duty for all Coconino County. And Coconino County is either the largest or the second largest county. It's bigger than Rhode Island, Connecticut. So right now, north of the Grand Canyon National Park and the North Rim, there's probably one deputy. And we seen the one just walk through while we were getting interviewed, and he's probably the only guy north of Williams right now. That's 58 miles. It's not to say it's bad, but I think it's indoctrination into the Park Service mentality now, where it's not everybody's either lesser than you because you wear green pants and a big Smokey Bear hat. But we still have good rapport with, like, you know, some of the Wildland guys and, like, the Interp Rangers and a lot of those people. It's just, I really don't know what has happened. But, you know, to have a 19-year-old girl who's carrying a gun come up and tell me how to run my scene, I could be her grandfather. And I've been doing it longer than she's been alive. So I always tell everybody, I was a gleam in, I've been doing this since you were a gleam in your father's eye.
So help me out here, because it seems in the early 1990s, there was no EMS in Tucson, and the Park Service was doing the providing of the ambulance service and law enforcement as well. And then slowly, Tucson basically grew up with what we have today, which is this next station, and the law enforcement now, of course, is, as you say, one gentleman comes in as a deputy for Coconino County Sheriff's Department. But now the Park Service has moved away again, back to the other side of the boundary, if you will. Is this a fair approximation of what's going on?
I would say so. I call it the invisible Ponderosa fence. Like right now, if a bus was on fire right north of that invisible line, we're closer, but they wouldn't call us. If there is a cardiac arrest right now at the parking lot right beside the entrance station, Guardian's sitting here, so are we. We're what, a mile and a half away? They're eight. They wouldn't call us. That's their property.
I think too, like, you know, years ago, because we were just starting out, and we were going on calls with all the Park Service back then. They knew us. They knew what we were struggling with and what we were trying to get started. And so they were very supportive, you know, and we all knew each other and got along. And it was kind of like we're all in the same business, and there was no, I don't know what the word is.
Disconnect.
Yeah, disconnect. But now...
And the other thing is the other thing like that, like she's trying to say, Sherry Collins, who was the EMS coordinator or whatever, Echo One or whatever they used to call her back then, she's the one that taught us EMT. Her, Nancy, Tammy Keller, that Dave Brennan, I mean, all those guys. I mean,
they were the group, very supportive.
Yeah, everybody is supportive. We all knew each other. We used to have this little group that lasted for a while where we all, it was called like the emergency service provider thing. We hit, you know, we'd meet, you know, every couple of months and all talk. And, you know, you go on scene of a plane crash and you would know, it's all first name basis. Sherry, man, I'm glad you're here. This is what we got. Boom, 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 boom. You know, mm-hmm. It's not that anymore. Because I think what's happened up there is that's more of a training ground than where it got people used to be there. Like Sherry, retired, went to Coconino, retired from Park Service, went and became the emergency management coordinator for Coconino County. You go there and she'd give you a hug, Robbie, you know, it's just like, you know, and, you know, and that's what you'd see. Everybody, you know, everybody would Ken Phillips. Retire, buy a house in Flagstaff. I mean, that's what these people did. You retire from here anymore, it's not, you know, you move from, I mean, how long you been here? Now it's the park superintendent. You get a 2-year gig and then you go someplace else. It's just boom. It's all a training ground for everybody.
So in the past, and I certainly remember when there would be a plane crash, everybody would scramble.
Mm-hmm.
Tucson, it would be the airport fire people. It
right.
would be the National mm-hmm. Park Service. It would be Zantara Fire and Safety.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would pile out. So, are you telling me now that if there was a plane crash outside of the park, that they would not respond?
No, they would respond.
They would respond. Okay, but you might not know them.
I would know the new chief, Anna Wajin, and maybe a few others, you know, Brandon and some others, just going through. But it's not like it used to be where we did, you know, when we worked at the airport, we'd do triennial exercises from the airport together. I mean, when we first took this over, we'd all do, like, we'd do a mass casualty incident, like we'd have a bus supposedly flip over and they'd all come out and we'd do all these pre-meetings and it's not that way anymore.
So there's no cross training then, or very little?
Very little.
Okay.
We tried, structural-wise, we tried to get with those guys and do some stuff. And when they did that, what was that called? Operation something or other?
The Angel Drill?
Oh, yeah. The Angel Drill. We went in when they had the scenario of an earthquake and the bus flipping over there, whatever that is, Yaki Point or something. We worked with them on that. But, you know.
So, what do you think was the cause of this?
Probably me, but no. I just think it's just... possibly disrespect on both sides' part of the Park Service Rangers treating us as... you know, oh, that podunk little fire department. I went to school for 2 years to get my paramedic certification, and so did their guys. I mean, we've been on bad stuff. I've been doing this. We were on the LVA crash out here, me and Laura and a lot of the old Park Service Rangers. I've seen dead, bad, bruised bodies. I've been on bad stuff. I've been on hotel fires. I've been on giant wildland fires. I'm medical unit leader qualified. I'm not a freaking hillbilly that, you know, we're coming in with beer between our legs on the fire trucks. We do everything at best of our ability within budget to do NFPA standards and OSHA stuff. I mean, I just feel sometimes it's disrespectful. I will call them if it's something big, but I try not to.
Yeah.
So as a outsider looking in, I wonder, before Tucson was built up with its own station, the number of runs that the Park Service made would have brought in a certain amount of funding because they could show, hey, we do this many calls, and now as that's all changed, they may be desperate to handle what they can, because otherwise they'll have to turn away their whole shop because you guys can clearly do it.
Is there any
of that happening? Does that make sense as a question? Because I'm not so sure it's a personal thing more than it's a territory for budget thing. Could that be a part of that?
It might be. You know, it's really small. I don't know how many calls they actually did out here, but I know some of their numbers are, we get paid 90% on all our transport calls. And some of the things they do, I think, are ethically and morally wrong. They'll bring a patient 8 miles in their ambulance and charge him money, drop him off here, put him in Guardian's ride. Guardian goes halfway to Flagstaff, another 40 miles, and meets another ride, and they take the patient. So that's three different, and it's all about this, the cash. And they say, oh, we get paid 90%. Guardian's tied in with FMC. They don't even get 60%. I don't know how they're getting 90% unless they're picking people up by the ankles and shaking the money out of their pocket. And you've been here long enough to know that, just like in Tucson and every other place, minimum wage workers, if you offer them insurance, they ain't going to pay for it. If they offer them insurance.
So how do you think the lack of insurance for the community impacts the operations of your shop here?
Well, we really don't charge because we're tax-based, but, you know, in this day and age, you grew up in the same generation I did, pretty much. You had a doctor as a child that probably birthed you, and you might have had him till your probably late teens, early 20s, and then his son took over the practice. It's not that way anymore. It's like you go to the clinic, you're lucky there might be a doctor there. They may have a buffalo head on and some blue corn pollen, but they need to fire me. But I mean, it's not like it used to be, and I think the people that basically use most of EMS resources, like I always could tell these guys, said, I'm going to get a trophy, and for the guy we transport the most that year, I'm going to give him a trophy for most runs, because you will have the same people over and over and over. You know what I mean? Alcohol addiction, drug addiction, mental problems. I mean, and they're the ones that use the system. The people, Mexican American community, won't use the system. They will go, well, I got this medication from my cousin, and that's their, how they do stuff. And they are so afraid of getting in trouble or being deported that the money costs. You always get them, oh, we won't go. My cousin will drive me to the clinic. Next 4 hours later, well, I took my cousin's medication. Did you go to the clinic? No. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, you go on some people 4, 5, 6, 7 times. Mexican American community, if your leg's hanging off, they'll just put your pants back on and drive you at the flag. You know, that's just how they aren't going to pay that money.
So, what do you remember about, what are some of the calls, looking back over the last 10 years, that went well? Or maybe we should talk about the stuff that didn't go well first, and then stuff that did go well.
It's like Laura talks about calls, or I talk about calls, and look at it and go, I don't remember that. But I think it's all perspective on where you were and what happened. It's kind of like when when you see your brothers and sisters and they're talking about being a kid, remember that time you drove your car real fast and you hit the tree and you went in the ditch? Man, me and my friends were so excited we were in the car with you. And I'm like, what? Me? It wasn't me. Were you dreaming? But I think the first really big incident we did as a crew together and with the Park Service was the Las Vegas airline crash, where we had all those people go down back then, Forest Service compound, blinding, you know, pretty much a snowstorm, plane lost an engine. We lost, what was there, 12 people died in that?
12 or 13, I think we had two survive, fireball.
Yeah. But that's all we could hear was the tower going, he's down, we have a fireball, is all I can remember. And I remember we tried to get out there as the airport, and the snow was 3 foot, what was it, February?
Yeah, 13.
See, what time? she's got all that. She might not remember anything else, but she can tell you.
It's like you said, it's a difference, because we went out there a few years ago, and we didn't really know the coordinates where the wreck was, but we wanted to go back out and walk it. And so neither one of us really remembered, but he remembered enough, and I remembered enough, and then all of a sudden, we look down and I'm like, oh, we're here, because we're walking around on, broken glass,
and then we started finding pieces of the aircraft. But we had driven out there like four or five different times trying to remember.
And it changes, and how you remember stuff in your head. That I took pictures and comparing them with like the newspaper clipping, it was like, oh yeah, But as soon as we looked down, I was like, oh yeah, we're here.
And like she kept going, no, it's by a little cedar tree. And I go, no, it was a big ponderosa pine tree they hit.
We're in the middle of the woods arguing about it.
Well, see, her perspective is when I went in, I had a truck that got buried right after the 10X Ranch when we were going back up. So me and another guy both grabbed jump kits or little medical bags and started hiking in with our bunker gear on, and Papillon helicopter landed in front of us and picked us up.
Air Star
didn't get me. I went in Papillon. No, I think Dan Tobin went in Air Star.
Oh, I thought Ron Williams took you.
No. And we flew in Papillon, and I'm a brand new ET going. We're flying over this wreckage, and all I can see is like busted up airplane smoke, pieces of debris everywhere, and I'm thinking, why in the hell am I flying in an aircraft to an airplane crash? Anyway, me and Joel Rosenberg, who is now, is he a captain with Verde Valley Fire? A lot of us old timers out there. We land, we hike up this hill. We get there, there's just aircraft parts strewn all over the place. And I walk up and there's a little, Taiwanese girl. She's jabbering at me and smoke's coming out of her mouth and her skin is just, all she has on is a pair of cotton panties because all the rest through the fireball burned off. They were in the tail section and shot through, and her and one other girl.
Her sister.
Still shakes me up to think about it to this day, but she's probably hypothermic when we got there, so Joel and I started trying to, work her, but all we had was a thermometer, a pair and some old band-aids in these things. So basically what we did is kind of stabilized her and still freaked out about it. And I tried to cut the burning clothes off because that's kind of what you were taught back then. So I started to try to pull what was left of her spandex, or whatever she had on. It probably wasn't spandex back then, but her skin was just sloughing off with it.
And we tried to get a set of eyeballs. And
you weren't there yet.
Oh.
All I can remember is Sherry Collins in the big orange jumpsuit showed up with you guys, and I was never so happy to see. Because it's like this, like trying to stop an invasion with a ballpoint pen. Well, that's what it felt like. You're trying to stop a flood with nothing. I mean, there's nothing you can do. You're in the middle of the woods. It's cloudy. You hardly have any air resources. There's me and Joel. And I'm like, what are we doing out here? And then my good buddy Alex Ocampo flies back over with Air Star, old Ron Williams, God rest his soul. Or him or Bob Bowker. I don't know who. I think it was Ron. But we needed backboards because we knew we had at least two viable patients out there. There was another one Dan Tobin was with, I think, on the other side. My buddy Alex, him and I still hunt together this day, but I always give him grief. We always laugh about it. I go, "You did that on purpose, didn't you?" He goes, "What?" I said, "When you dropped that backboard," because it came out of the helicopter and went coming right down there, so we didn't know where to run. I said, "You tried to make me a casualty." But we did get out of the way, and we did get her backboarded and stuff, but it was pretty. But she was burned. The good thing about all this is what she ended up in the burn center in Maricopa County, and she now is a burn unit nurse at Maricopa County. A very good success story on our part. I don't know how well we did out there, but Laura and Sherry and you're going to have to remember. I remember Paul Simpson was there and Rodney, but that's all I can remember.
We were having a hard time because we were trying to go in and we kept getting stuck in the mud. So yeah, we were hiking with backboards and all this equipment, and then finally one of the sheriff's deputies showed up in his pickup truck, and he had four-wheel drive, and he had us all hop in the back of the pickup truck, and we drove up on scene, and we were able to. And I remember seeing Robbie and Sherry.
I'm so glad you guys got there, because I was there by myself for like a day and a half.
Like forever,
I was getting hungry.
That's what it felt like trying to get to it, because it was so frustrating and you couldn't get there.
Oh, and there was no radio comms. Yeah. I remember that. Our airport radios we didn't have a repeater. We didn't have park frequencies. I kept trying to go over to NIMS and nobody's answering. It was just.
Yeah. And if you ever want to see pictures or the story that Mike, what is his name, he does lostflights.org.
McComb.
Yeah. He came and interviewed us about that wreck, and then he went out there and took pictures and wrote a bunch of stuff up about it.
And he's now working for the FAA.
I know. Yeah. That's perfect.
That's good. That's a good gig for him. It's right
up
his alley.
Absolutely.
He's so good at that. Amazed. Yeah. But he did a big story on that flight.
But that was our first call, and I went back. My buddy, who's now the chief of Highlands Fire, I called him when I got home because I think it was my first post-traumatic stress syndrome thing before anybody called it that.
I don't remember exactly who said it, but they wanted us to go put snow on the bodies that were still burning. To try to extinguish it. Yeah, I know who said it.
I didn't even know. We worked this girl beside a engine, and there was a pile of airplane and a fire, and at some point through all this, somebody said, "Throw snow on that fire to preserve the integrity of the bodies." Because I at that point, I'd been right beside him within 10 feet the whole time, and I never knew it was human flesh burning.
You're so focused on what you're doing, you don't even realize your surroundings.
It still shakes me up. I feel all glitchy up here.
Sorry.
But it was. I mean that. And I think that either makes, and like in this business, sometimes we go on calls and I have a probie with me and I go, "Don't look at the body. Don't look at the body. I want to look at the body." And don't look at the body. But they all have to. And it's like, all right, here goes your carousel, because you're going to have this the rest of your life. Every time you go, it's going to be, the smell of grilling red meat. LVA crash, 1992. Diesel, smell of blood. Bus versus car with decapitation, front of the airport, 1994.
Or the sage. What is that sage on the side of the road? Every time I smell that, I think of plane wrecks.
You know, it's just. But they won't listen to you.
But a good friend of ours told us, Jim Coffey, that your brain basically will take a Polaroid of those pictures, and whether you want to or not, sometimes you get a slideshow, and you start collecting.
And then every time you go, "Not again, I'm trying to sleep, I'm tired." 1992 LVA crash. Oh no, not the one in front of the airport. Oh.
There's so many now, you don't even.
I still think they get me.
The last a couple of days or something, but
not like it used to be, where you were just really shaking
out. I think it's a lot harder, and that's why I tell people, it's like your first year, if you're starting to see a lot of dead bodies, it's really hard. because you're seeing the worst things ever, you know, in a, you know, not a stable setting usually. And if you can get through that first year and you can deal with it, then, you know.
You might be able to do this job.
You might be able to, yeah. So. It's just how you have to, you know, find a way to deal with stuff, you know, whether it's spiritually or whatever your beliefs are. But you have to have, as Robbie and I say, you have to have a place to put it, but you also have to have people that you could talk to about it. And that's why Robbie and I have been such good partners and friends all these years, because for 20 years we've been on so much together and we know each other. We've been partners.
Oh,
that we just...
We don't have to talk. It's like we go out on scene and we'll be doing even a junky medical call and I'll go, I'm going to do this. And she's like, I don't even have to worry about what she's going to do because she's already doing it. I mean, even if we go to an accident right now, it's like I don't have to worry about what. I don't have to tell her what to do because she's just going to do it. But there's this old story. We did a head-on 105 miles an hour with this car versus a pickup truck. And we walk up, and it's, 11 o'clock at night. Sean Shields, DPS guy, is there. And this brings all of your little movie thing together. I walk up, take one smell, and I go to Laura. Ooh, that smell. Can't you smell? The Leonard Skinner. And Sean Shields looks at me, and she just loses it and starts laughing.
Because we're extricating this poor gentleman.
We're cutting this people, this dead guy out of
the bus. Nobody wants to help us.
Because nobody wants to look at it.
So Robbie and I are like, let's just get it done. And it's just him and I on the extrication units and equipment.
Yeah, this guy took B post to B post, and his head was like...
Yeah, he was broken everywhere. So we pull him out, and Robbie starts singing the song, and I just start losing it, laughing. It's dark humor. You shouldn't have it, but unfortunately...
Well, that just the smell. It was just the smell of it surrounds you.
Yeah, it's very true.
You know, and like she said, faith. You know, I was raised a Roman Catholic. I don't know what I believe anymore or anything, but I mean, you have to have faith that it's like last week or the week before we did that gal got killed on a bike on 180, got hit by somebody we knew. And it's like I was telling somebody and I went, you never know. I said, when God opens the door, you're going, I'm not ready yet. Oh yeah, you are, because it could happen to anybody. You know, it's just when it's your time to go, hook, crook. There's no getting out of it. I mean, how many times we've all driven this highway and been that close?
Yeah, very true.
You know,
has that affected how you think about life and caring and kindness?
Yes. I would say yes. I think sometimes in this business people lose that, but I think that, like Robbie and I know that we have empathy and, you know, we care about, I think that's why we're still here. It's like, if Tucson Fire goes away and Guardian goes away, who's going to be here? The closest hospital is 80 miles away with Flagstaff. And I care who's out on that highway, you know, and us to not be able to go respond. And we don't know if it's friends, family, loved ones, or even a tourist that we don't know. But we're all people. We all have bad days. And
every call you should do should be everybody that you go on. If you walk out this, if we get paged out right now and we go to a hotel room, those people should be treated like it was your mom.
Or your dad or your brother or your sister.
Alan Brutacini used to say that from Phoenix Fire. Every patient should be treated like you'd want your family to be treated.
And I think we try to do that. I mean, it does get hard sometimes if you have somebody being combative or belligerent, but you try. And like we had a lady in here this morning that, you know, was in tears, and you just put your arm around her, and, you know, I don't know her, but she needs some TLC, you know, and I think people are either have it or they don't, it seems like, you know.
Yeah, I think some people like the idea of the blue shirt as a superhero cape and I'm a firefighter thing. You don't see any firefighter stickers on my truck.
That's because that's not what it's about.
It's not the blue superhero cape.
It goes back to both of us being raised back east, because the fire department was the core thing, you know, that we talked about. because you just, you know, you want to help, you know.
And it's like me, I think, like Laura says, there's somewhere you got to take that stuff and the bad juju and stick it in that locker and make it go away. And lock it up till the next time. But my personal feeling, I grew up in a very large Roman Catholic family. Just pray to God every Christmas. Think, how can there be a God? You get all these presents and you have to go to church. He's not fair. But anyway, I think I lost a brother that got hit and killed right in front of me by a car when he was 3 years old. I had a sister who was 13, and I go away from that. But anyway, she got hit and killed by a car by a guy 2 doors down. That's where I get. When the door opens, we lived in the country. She slipped on a piece of ice. We walked down that road thousands of times. And the guy 2 doors down went by and a bumper caught her in the back of the head. She would have been a brain dead. And so my mother, I'm an organ donor. My mother always, that was first kidney transplant, or one of the first kidney transplants in America. My mother always said, somebody can have my eyes, they're bad, but they can have them. They're better than none. Not anymore, but you know, it's just, I think I've been able to take stuff. I know when we did the bus versus car and the decapitation, everybody's out there, it was a hot summer day, and all I could smell was blood and death, and I just kept, and we had to clean up, there was internal all over the road, and we had to sweep it up and wash it down, and all I can remember is telling buddy, it's a dead elk, boys, it's a dead elk, just treat it as a dead elk, they aren't here, it's a dead elk. But that was one of those eerie calls, working at the airport. And that's just like the LVA crash. Whatever could go wrong in a big call did go wrong. They go, oh, there's an accident in front of the airport. All right, I'm going to go with my ops truck. I'm thinking, oh, somebody hit a deer, as usual. Get up there, drive up, and go, oh, my God. We need every, or what I do to dispatch.
Send me everything you got.
Yeah, that chair used to put that on all the MCI flyers. Send me everything you got. I got there. This car hit a bus. Families, the whole thing's peeled. The roof's peeled back like a tuna fish can. There's one, I think, fire security guy happened to be driving by on. See, I can't remember his name anymore. That comes with age. I go up. I have the same jump kit as I had last time, with a rectal thermometer and an old Band-Aid. And there's the passenger's alive. The driver's DRT, dead right there. You go over to the back side, and the kid is, top of his head's gone, and he has the death card from a tarot packet in his hand, still there. To this day, that gives me the willies. And then the park showed up. Well, and that was one of those airport, yeah, and Laura, she had to pull her skirt up like this because she was actually the secretary at the airport with an EMT.
Yeah.
Had to put it to get her bunkers on.
So the supervisor was like, you go. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, that was a nasty scene.
It was.
I'm like, Laura, look at this. It's like your hairs are standing up.
Well, I didn't even know until the next day that it wasn't convertible. I thought it was a convertible the whole time, and he was like, no. I'm like, oh.
So
the best one.
So anyway, all the fire trucks broke down. We couldn't get what Charlie 2 started.
Yeah.
It broke down just going out the gate to get out there with the extrication tools. Once again, Sherry, Nancy, Ken, to the rescue. Mm-hmm. It was quite something. Well, there was ones you didn't eat dinner after.
We were out there for hours. The highway was
shut down, so we were directed. We had people directing traffic through the, I think, the airport, I think, where the heliports weren't even open then, were they? Or just
no,
open?
I don't think so.
But we were directing them.
North and south entrance was different.
Yeah.
But we directed traffic through, and then we went from being initial responders to being, taking people to the clinic, because we also had a whole bus full of, I think, Taiwanese again.
Mm-hmm.
And then after everything was said and done, then they put us on traffic control. And then finally, like, the sun started setting and we finally cleared the call, finally got the bus moved. And so we were out there for like the whole day. I think it was like 11 o'clock or something, the accident happened. But it just shut down the whole highway, basically. You get to wear a lot of different kind of hats.
Yes. So 50 years from now, the chief of this station is going to find this recording. What do you want to tell her?
I'm sorry. I tried to do a good job. They hired me. We were actually drinking pizza, or eating pizza and drinking beer with the board, and we were looking at all the applications. I went to the bathroom. When I came out, I was a fire chief. I'm sorry. Well, here's what I'm going to tell you. I hope the Grand Canyon this beautiful national forest isn't surrounded by commercial development. I know there'll be some development in 50 years, but, you know, it's beautiful country, and I hope it stays that way. And I hope if there is any kind of development or growth, that it actually is minimal impact to the infrastructure, the water, and the animals up here in the forest.
And that you have the budget that you can get the things that you need with it.
Yeah, you can't dance with angels on the head of a pin with trying to protect 405 million people on a paltry budget and two people. Today, we might put gas in a fire truck.
But it also sounds like there's a camaraderie here and a lot of fun with what you do, and I think you would want them to know that as well. Am I wrong with that?
No, I think, yeah.
It's fire. It's fire is, you're not going to find this in any other profession. Firefighters are a brotherhood. To the Wednesday, International Association of Firefighters Motorcycle Rally, we have 200 motorcycles, 250, I don't know, we had about 500 people because all the wives were with them. Most of them all retired. All shaking hands, we're hugging. It's like, tell them a story. A guy from FDNY comes in, he was on 9/11. She starts talking to him. By the time they're done, she's crying, he's crying. I mean, it's all.
Yeah, he was showing me pictures of his friends that passed away on that day, and all I could do was give him a hug, because, you know, what do you say? And his wife was a nurse in one of the hospitals that day. And then we all went outside and started talking, and then we're all just crying, and, you know, what do? You just give him a hug and stay safe
even,
out there.
Even in Arizona, it's, we all starred together. Paul Simpson, it was called Fred Harvey, Fire. Yeah, I don't even know if they did security back then. Back when Dan Nichols was the fire chief, he's now the PIO captain for Summit Fire. Dirt Foreman worked with us at the airport. He just became the chief a month ago out at Highlands Fire. Joe Rosenberg at the airport, a captain with Verde Fire. Jim Stout, captain, Gila Bend Fire, Casa Grande. Another guy I work with, Danny Parker, retired Yavapai Central. His son was one of the kids that got killed on the Yarnell 19. I can't remember his name, but their squad boss, who I can't remember his name right now, he taught some of my classes at Wildland Fair. It's a community. It's a family. Dirk's kid, when he was working with us at the airport, 3 years old, he used to run around in a little, dress-up fire outfit. August Foreman is now on the Bear Jaw crew, that Wildland firefighting out of Dirk's thing. They were up in Idaho when I was down at Dirk and Susan's here a month ago. I mean, it's just this big, my dad did it. I got into it. I think I got into it for the beer and the camaraderie at the little town, but you see it everywhere. It's like, you'll go to Heber Overgaard. But Mike, we went to high school with, he now works at Mesa Fire. Him and I were at the Wildland Fire Academy having some beers just BS, and we, walked the hill together every day for PT. He'd kind of jog, I'd walk. But he's like, you know, I don't know if he's assistant chief at Heber Overgaard now, but it's this big, giant community thing. I mean, it's like families. I mean, it's back east. If you grow up back east, my grandfather was on the Boston Police Department, or my grandfather was a Boston firefighter. My dad was a Boston firefighter, and they'll give you the station. I'm a Boston firefighter, you know, and that's how it is. And I mean, that's the family. If you look, like on the 9/11 thing, you'll see, like, you read stories, it's like guys' sons, you know, guys were captains on, you know, or lieutenants with NYPD, their sons were killed in that, or their dads were killed in that, because it is multi-generational thing. You know, it's like the military thing for a lot of people. And it's just a big brotherhood. It's like right now, even though as you are here, you see people wandering up front, because this isn't really a working fire station. You know, we have tour buses full of firefighters come through. We'll have days where we'll have like 60 people on a tour bus. They want to try on your stuff because they're from France, or they're from...
What kind of equipment do you use?
My daughter, because I get so tired of dealing with these guys, because they think... My daughter... You need to talk to him on Facebook. She's been trying to get a hold of you. His daughter. He's coming to America first time. He's from Hungary. He's a firefighter. So I got, like, what, 40-proof Plum vodka with a bunch of shot glasses and a hat and a shirt, and I made Laura take it because I had another meeting. But, I mean, that is... Oh, your German helmet. She had a German helmet with the thing. I don't know what they used it for, to ram it through the door or something. But, I mean, all that stuff. You look at all the patches, everybody, T-shirts. It's just this weird. It's like the motorcycle thing. We're all hugging, shaking hands. Thanks for what you do. I mean, it's the only job in the world. I can go into, like, right now, Laura and I could go over to Wheatcliff and take you and have lunch. And somebody we don't even know will go, thank you for what you do.
We even had a firefighter come that time from Ireland. He was from Dublin, and we could hardly understand him because his accent was so thick. But before he left, he was hugging all of us, and, you know, I mean, it's like a brotherhood even that far away. It's really wild.
Mm-hmm. It's just that, I mean, last year we had a bus. The International Western Fire Chiefs Association sent a bus here with 30 Japanese firefighters. I have a kimono somewhere. It's too short, so I don't wear it. And some fans. I mean, it's just this weird, different thing. I've never seen anything like it. You know, you can always say, I belong to the union. I'm a union electrical worker. But hey, nothing like this. I mean, you go right now and just knock on a fire station door and know. It's like here. There's guys, it's hunting season. I know every year the guys from Tucson, if they get drawn up here, they're up here. Steve Winicky with Flag, he's their hazmat guru. He gets a bull-out tag up here for archery. Hey, mind if my brothers are coming out from Pittsburgh for this hunt. Mind if we come and use the shower once in a while and flip our way? Oh, go ahead. I mean, that's just how the whole thing, you know. You need a hand. Oh, come on out to the camp. Have a couple beers tonight. You know, and that's how it just is. The whole thing is just so, it's just a whole different mindset, I think.
So it's interesting because that collegiality makes to me a lot of sense, and yet what's missing is that community foundational. My grandfather, my father, I am a... So the people that come here from afar, they don't see that is missing here, because you guys aren't missing that per se, but you are, but they don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So
the community doesn't see it. Because nobody has a clue what you do. Mm-hmm. Nobody has a clue. And we've been talking about, she mentioned something about, you know, money woes and trying to, nobody knows. The current, we incorporated a few years ago, we've lost $3 million of our assessed valuation, which was a quarter of our budget. in the last 5 years. So we're really struggling to keep our head above water. Going to the political regime, it's you beg, and then they make you jump through another hoop. This time we want you to dance on the head of a pin with a kilt on. They serve 2 hours at a meeting, 2 days a month. Gee, what do we do? Oh, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I have to get up.
24/7,
because we still come back for everything. We have duty guys, but if it's something big and bad, we come back. And we are there on the people's worst day of their life. I'm on vacation. We came to the Grand Canyon. We've wanted to come here all our life. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Wife's crying. They've saved for years to come here, and her husband has a cardiac arrest in a hotel room. They don't deal with that. We deal with that. And the worst, and like we were talking before, you're out there, it's bad, it's nasty, and we just don't go up and go, Tom, sorry for your loss. We want her a different hotel room without her husband's body in it. Is there anything we can get you? And this is what we get letters for. That nice girl got me a cup of tea. That's what they remember. They don't remember you busting your butt working on their husband or their loved one. They'll remember they all gave me a hug. Girl got hit on the road. I knew the gal hit her. Nothing she could do. All I could do was try to console her. I seen her 2 days ago over at Ann's. She's a tour guide up here. She came up and gave me a great big hug and said, thank you so for much. And because I felt inadequate trying to console anybody, because, you know, blue collar Robbie telling jokes. But, she gave me a hug and just went, thank you so much for what you, I mean, she couldn't even dial her phone. I called her husband for her, told him what was going on, sympathize with her. And that's what people remember.
But you just trained me. It's what you would do to your brother or your mom or your sister or your dad,
mm-hmm.
or your son or your daughter. It's what you do for family.
Worst call ever. And this wasn't even a nasty call. Paged out for a rollover on the Willahaw Ranch where the power line's going across. Me and Laura rolling with two pretty much probies on board. We drive up. It's my best friend who him and I have been hunting together here and been next door neighbors and drank and ate since I got here in 1992. His wife's in the passenger seat. We think she's dead. So it's the same thing, just like everything. What can break today, Laura? So we're trying to get the door off. And my buddy, he's rolled the truck over. He's immaculate. I think he might have had, a cut on his hand. Alex never gets dirty. And we're like, he goes, I don't think Rose is doing good. We go in and it's like, Laura's like, we need to get her out of here and get her out of here now. So we're trying to get the door open, and it's one of those days where the door is, like, the metal's ripping, but the door won't pop. Her and I are like, I throw the tools away, I'll rip the freaking door off. We got a helicopter, we were all freaked out. I mean, I was freaked out, and everybody's like afterwards, why? I don't know why you guys were so up. I was like, Sue Yen that works up here at the gate, she used to come to our house when my wife was alive, when she was like in fourth grade. I mean, I've known this family, I've seen him grow up, I've seen him have babies. Alex and I made a pact, like sometime in the early 90s. We'll keep coming to the Grand Canyon area and hunting together until we can't do it anymore. Even if we both move away, and Alex is retired, but him and I have seen some shooty stars drinking mezcal, and like I said, I'm going to retire here pretty soon, and I'm going to really miss this area. I'm going to miss a lot of people. I have a lot of I have a lot of regrets about going. Because like my mama told me, she says, where are you going to go after this? Because there's no place to live here. And that's why I'm deciding to make a move. And I was like, God, her and I have been together, so 20-some years. These kids we got volunteering in their 20s, I mean, little Cody Betancourt, I remember getting here and going to a poster roll, and he was in Pampers. Now him and Heather are having a baby. They're having a baby shower this weekend. I mean, it's just, and I mean, it taught him fire, taught him MET. We got, Heather was working at Papillon. She took the EMT class. She went to school for nursing and got out of it and got into business. So that would be too hard. As soon as she got done with her EMT, right to nursing school, working at, what, Tuba City now? I mean, it's just, you know that thing, pass it on. My personal opinion is that's what I'm here for, is I take what I know, pass it on. Because that's what you're here for, is basically my feeling. Give them the knowledge you have, try to pass on what you have, you know, don't take what you have and go, it's mine and I'm not going to hand it out. Because what you're here for is either to give it to your kids, which I really don't have any, except, you know, which I call my daughter, who is actually my sister's daughter, who me and Debbie raised, but pass it on, give it to the kids. They're the ones that, like, this morning when I, on the Facebook thing where I put, Kelly, she goes, because she's all upset about me leaving here, because she grew up and went to school here, graduated high school here, you know. I went, hey, I have to move on. It's my time, my generation's turn to move on. I said, please, it's your generation's turn to take over, and you better do a better effing job than what we did.
But I'll step in and say, they never taught us in physical therapy school how to leave. And I bet in firefighting, they never taught you that either. Meaning, mm-hmm. They sort of retire, you go, but you take so much with you. So ponder that one. I mean, it's just, we never get that training. It's like how to get things in place, how to make things work, and when you have to step out of that, there's, what do you do? How does it happen? How do you?
Old fat man doesn't know. Old fat man, I think, is going to either, I've got some things, I've got some apps in back east. I'm actually thinking my uncle in this little town I'm going to is kind of a big cheese, and I'm either going to go see, I'll have to get my paramedic transferred over, but either go volunteer, because New York versus Arizona, I think if you're a volunteer like firefighter or EMT, they give you breaks on your taxes every year. What a concept
is that?
If you're in a big business, you still get a break on your taxes versus Arizona where, look, these guys come in here for free. Oh, you people are going to charge you.
I don't think you ever lose it, though, because we were, you know, talking to a lot of those guys that came for the IAF, and there were some that we talked to that just retired or been retired for 17, some 16 years. And I said, do you miss it? And he's like, I do and I don't. You know, I think you miss the people and the camaraderie, and that's what he misses, but he doesn't miss the calls, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anybody in this business, that's probably what you miss, is the people.
Well, I think a lot of it too, it's just like here, you know, there's people that have your back. At least you feel that they have your back. Like, hey, if you go down in a burning building, they'll let the building burn, but they're going to get you out if it kills them. And that's how you should feel about everybody you're working with, you know? It's just a weird, weird... And it'll be weird for me to go, but I also thought, you know what I could do? Even if the colleges don't teach EMTB or fire stuff, I have all my certs. Just do like they did at Wizard. Start my own little company and go, here's what we're going to do. Instead of having your crazy, it's September, time for school, you got 3 months. Do something different. Go out and start teaching fire and EMTB. I mean, and charge the students money. I mean, it can be done. There's all kinds of...
He's retiring, but he's not.
I don't think I could ever retire. Well, I plan on hunt and fish and...
Having more time where you're not on that flipping page or...
Well, it's kind of what, you know, with money problems and... This used to be a pretty tight-knit, cohesive community, and it's gotten better since the incorporation, but it's still a lot of promises and no delivering. And it's a company town, and it's always going to be a company town. The people that have money are going to have money, and a little guy like me is never going to be able, even if they do commercial development outside of Tucson, you're never going to be able to open a pub or a pizzeria, because what'll happen is all that'll go to the people that still have the money and the power. It's just simple as that. I mean, I love some of these people I truly love that sign my paycheck and are on my board, but you know, there's a big disparity between, oh, I'm off work, I'm going to have some drinks, and Laura and I, well, we can't drink tonight. This guy's mother's sick, so he's taking care of his wife. And, oh, this guy's got EMT refresher, or, you know, oh, we got to listen again tonight. Oh, Tim's late man at the airport. We got to listen to 8 o'clock tonight. It was like last night. Found out I was going to close in my house. I was going to have beers, but Ray gets here late on Thursdays. Tim doesn't get off till late. Even though Cockrum said he would listen.
We're always listening.
I know, but it's just, it'd be nice to have a day where you could just go, I'm going to have a beer.
Some downtime.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of downtime.
Because.
And if you go to Flag, you think, oh, maybe I'll go to the movies. And but no, I got to go to Walmart and PetSmart, and then I got to go to the grocery store. I got to go to 2 grocery stores.
Yeah, the guy interviewed us needs a CPR card. But he did give me 2 books. By the way, great, both of them.
You gotta go to the pharmacy, and you gotta drive
70 miles home.
Yeah, and you're already tired, and then you get home, gotta unload everything, put everything away.
Hit late for the train, get a rail bender, so then you can't sleep and get home because you're like.
I got all the laundry to do tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the pager goes off, and you're like, "Can you come?" Like, I guess I'm going.
It's bad, real bad.
Yeah. You really don't get that much days off. People think we, you know, like when you're off, but we're really never off. Unless you do have a beer, because then you can't grill, but.
And then you always feel guilty when the pager goes off for something bad because you had beer.
Because then we're listening, going, oh crap. Do the right thing.
You're going to kill somebody. One of those things.
You're always the mother hen.
You're babysitting, you always feel like you got to babysit, even though I think that's probably one of our faults. Is not being able to go. I've been doing it for 15 years. I should be able to damn handle it.
But I always feel like a mother hen too, because I always worry about the guys.
But in this community, I would, in your defense, I'd say in this community, given the small number of people that you have here to draw from, everybody helps. It's like when you saw Sherry walking through the snow, you were like, thank heavens.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense is everybody else sees you guys show up, and it's you don't have a lot, somebody else shows up with more experience than you, it is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So
that makes sense.
And I just
never feel like I'm that person. I always feel like the person at LVA. Like, Sherry, yay!
Yeah. There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Yeah. But I want to thank you guys for your service as well. One thing you said, Robbie, really struck me. The community hasn't a clue, except for the people that volunteer here, mm-hmm. and their wives and husbands and daughters and sons and mothers and fathers, because they tell the stories to, they know.
Mm-hmm.
But third person removed will not know. So thank you. And I know
it's a perfect example of a town council meeting. We did a presentation, and they asked about how to make the crosswalk safer. And being a big mouth I am, I could not talk. And I said, I don't know how to make the crosswalk safer. But I said, after being on one where the girl went through the windshield of the car, something needs to be done. I said, if they're not safe as they are, having all those crosswalks in the street, I said, I don't know what the answer is, but you guys need to fix it. Because there's nothing. It's dark. They've been driving 75 miles an hour till they get to the roundabout. And we've done enough Evel Knievel jumps over the roundabouts, you know, because they're going too fast. And those crosswalks, people got a false sense of security. Back in the old days, we'd look for cars and then run like hell. Now it's like these people think they're going to step out there in the evening when you got 7,000 cars leaving the park right after the sunset, and they think people can see them. You can't see them.
Well, the Brits, if you put your foot on the crosswalk, they have to stop. Here in the States, it's like, are you testing me? Let's find out.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. So,
yeah. It's, and we've done three pretty bad ones already. And that's not even all the, like you said, the roundabout accidents and so forth that we've done. And all the near misses we see every day.
I wonder if a walkover or a tunnel under or somehow just to get the people. Yeah.
Or the guy just going like this in the dark.
But
drunk, stumbling out of a bar.
Asks us, what exactly do you guys do all day? And it's like, they must think we just sit in here and watch TV or something that, you know.
No, that, on the days we haven't slept all night, if you go out there and sit in a barco lounger, I guarantee it never has never failed to happen. Mm-hmm. If you go out there and you play like 1 hour's sleep, and you go, oh, shit, we're up all night. I'm going to just go out here and take a little siesta. Guarantee.
Is this all you do all day?
Is this what you do all day?
Or how do you work in the office at 8:15? I called and called this morning. It's like, I was out till 5 o'clock, all the way in Flagstaff helping deliver a patient, you know, and I've had no sleep, which isn't safe. So I'm going to go home and get some sleep. Well, we need to get this done and this done in the office, and there are people calling, and it never ends. That's why I say, hopefully in the future, they'll have enough money to have people, and, you know, you're not having to wear all these different hats, you know.
It reminds me of why Dr. Werger and Dr. Myers left the clinic. Two guys running a 24-hour call, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, begging for another doctor. Not going to get it, because it's a money equation. Well, then you burn people out. Good people leave. Other good people come in, they leave. It is a big revolving door because somebody's looking at it from a financial line.
Because Robbie and I are salaried, so we try to just
look out. We have about a quarter an hour, some
it's,
months.
It's like, you know, so we take an extra day off here or there, but you're still kind of on call because even if you're home listening, you know, but you've got to have some kind of break. You can't be here all the time. You've got to have downtime. And even if you're home listening, it's better than being stuck here all the time.
You've got to have downtime for this job.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to have the compassion that you have, you have to fill that well back up again, which means you need time away.
Yeah.
If you don't get that, that well gets dried out fast.
And see, and that's the
burnout
with Werger and Myers, and just like us, you live where you work. It's not like I can get off at 5 o'clock and I drive, and my neighbor's a truck driver and his wife is something else, and we could all sit down and say, hey, let's come on over. We're going to barbecue some burgers and have a couple beers tonight. Not how it works here.
I'm sorry, I was going to say, Dr. Myers even told me that it affects you. It affects your sleep. It affects your health. You can't do it. That him and Werger tried, but you can't keep that pace up without it affecting you. And I already know it affects my sleep because I don't sleep good when I'm on. But man, when that weekend comes, I'll sleep for 12, 13 hours straight trying to play catch up, you know.
I think it's the alcohol.
Well, at least you have that availability. You lose that ability to get that sleep on your time off, then because your workload isn't.
But it's hard because then your days off are messed up because now you've slept till noon, and you just feel like you're driving all the time. You've still got all this stuff to do, and you know it never ends. But, you know, he can go home and sleep like a baby, and I'll be just always on the edge waiting for, you know.
That's because your nature is to worry about everything. It's not like me. The pager goes off, I just get up, say some cuss words, and go.
I'm a worrywart.
Well, I think I'll go to the bathroom before I get dressed. Stumble out the door, going, I wonder who's on duty. Put my milk run in front of me. I hope I'm going so slow that who's ever on duty beats me there and they cancel us.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for your service.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's good having you here today.
Definitely.
Thanks for...
Don't have to do office work.
That's good. That's
yeah,
good.
It's always good.
Wonderful.
Turn on the tape.